playmates from the 1960s were supposed to be young, fresh-faced, sexy, curvy women. And Victoria was all of those things.
Victoria Vetri saw what Playboy had done for actresses before her. She wanted to emulate the likes of Brigitte Bardot and Sophia Loren.
I'm gonna be a star!
There were so many triggers with her life and what happened to her and the Playboy lifestyle. I think it just did things to her that you can't come back from.
The Manson murders were exceptionally gruesome. The fact that there was a beautiful up-and-coming actress who appeared in Playboy at the center of it was horrifying.
Victoria was supposed to be at Sharon Tate's home.
The people who murdered her friends were out to get her.
Victoria's story is really a cautionary tale. Fame and success aren't a cure-all to everything.
Hey, y'all, welcome back to another edition of Docu Talk Through, the podcast where I talk you through the best documentaries in the streaming sphere. The title of the documentary for this episode is The Bunny and Charles Manson. Stunning actress Victoria Vetri becomes Playmate of the Year in 1968. But just a year later, followers of Charles Manson brutally murder her close friend, Sharon Tate. The crime sets in motion a series of events that ends in Victoria's tragic downfall. This is season 2, episode 2 of the Playboy Murders. All right, let's talk through it. Okay, so we are starting October 16, 2010, Los Angeles, California. And we start right off with two gunshots, rather. And we are hearing from Bob Bender, LAPD retired. And he's saying they received a call saying there were shots fired, victim down. They received multiple 911 calls describing shootings going on and a victim down. So when the officers arrived, they, you know, approached the location because they didn't know if the gunman was still on scene. So they were really cautious. It's a two-story multi-unit apartment building. And from all accounts, it just looked like a typical apartment in the heart of Hollywood. It wasn't luxury, but it wasn't projects. So we see this reenactment. The cops are going upstairs. They're approaching the location, being cautious. They got their guns out, and they see one victim down outside hallway. And they had a gunshot wound to the upper left chest. And so they enter the apartment and they see signs of a struggle. They see shit thrown everywhere, food all everywhere, alcohol bottles, lamps turned over, and they come across these torn up Playboy magazines all over the floor. And they realize that the woman on these magazines is Victoria Vetri, Playmate of the Year for 1968. So who is Victoria Vetri? Victoria Vetri is your typical California girl. She went to Hollywood High. She was a pretty girl growing up, Italian heritage, and she was pursuing a career as an actress. And we're speaking with Stella Tannenbaum. Remember Stella Tannenbaum from season 1, her and her husband. She was a hostess at the Playboy Mansion, and her husband was a chauffeur or a driver at the Playboy Mansion. So she has all the intel on the inside. So that's who we're hearing from, giving us starting off with the backstory of this, what's her name? Victoria, I'm gonna call her Vivi. Victoria Vetri, Vivi. All right. So that's who we're hearing from. And she was, Vivi was pursuing a career as an actress. Her dad was a successful restaurateur and her mother was a successful model. And I'm looking at this picture. Her mom, if this is her mom, because they showed a picture of earlier, and this looked like the same picture. Maybe she just looked just like her mom. Yeah, it's just, you know, the classic, like, JCPenney model that you would see, you know? So her mom had some success at modeling. And she started in 1962, and for some reason, you know, she already had the knack to know if her name would be good on a marquee or not. And she changed her name to Angela Dorian. And I guess she actually has some guest spots on a couple of TV shows as Angela Dorian. And we see this, what is this? This is Bonanza. So she had a cameo it wouldn't be a cameo. She had a little small part in Bonanza. And we see her portraying like this, What is it, like Flower Girl or something? She was in Ozzy and Harriet. She was in Cheyenne. And I guess her role models were Brigitte Bardot, Sophia Loren, and those kind of actresses. So evidently she had a bunch of spots on different TV shows. Now they just show Batman, the old Batman TV show. And I guess she had a part on that. So she had a bunch of roles on a bunch of Hollywood shows. So there was this thing called a Hollywood Death Star Ball. And it was where they would take nominees from TV shows, movie studios, talent agencies each year. And with her first year in Hollywood, Victoria Vetri was a Hollywood Death Star. Okay, so the Hollywood Death Star was just a bunch of women they took from all these shows that the movie studios say, hey, she should be a Hollywood Death Star. So I that's weird. I've never heard of that. So she was one of those Hollywood Death Stars. Is that still going on now? Or maybe it was something that faded out. But at the time, it was a prestigious title to be a Hollywood Death Star. So she started out really like gangbusters. You know, she seems like she was on her road to be an actress. But I guess she didn't go past TV. She just kept getting these little bit parts in these TV shows, but she never got any major movie roles. And then came Playboy. She started to notice how Playboy had launched other actresses' careers. See, I always thought the opposite. I always thought Playboy, and maybe it's changed, I always thought that women, after they fall off from acting or whatever, they do Playboy to sort of get a second boost. I thought that's the way it went. Like, after you became famous for something, and then that rise starts to either plateau, then you go do Playboy. And I could be wrong, but I thought that's the way it was. But evidently, in this case, it's not. It's like Playboy was a springboard in the earlier years. And maybe it's still like that now, but I'm getting it backwards. Yeah, because I think in the last season, it was the same thing where they used Playboy to springboard like a music career or something else, or more bigger modeling gigs and things like that. So that's what she was using this for. I mean, I guess it makes sense. You show your titties and then they call you for a serious acting role. See, that seems, they don't seem, it seems once your titty, once people see your titties, like who cares how you act? You know, who cares if you got any acting chops? You know what I mean? Like you can't show your titties and then try to get a serious acting role. To me, that don't make sense. But then again, I'm not the smartest person. So in the 60s, each issue of Playboy reached about 5 million readers. So yeah, man. So if you appear as a centerfold and that thing, you're gonna become popular. See, so okay, so nobody knows who invited Vivi to the Playboy mansion for the first time. But Holly Madison is saying, you know, regardless of that, yeah, she was so beautiful that she wouldn't have, even though she don't know who invited her, it would have been par for the course for her to be invited. So it wasn't all that weird. And we are hearing from Steven Tannenbaum. Okay, so he started out as the butler for Hugh Hefner and then later became the driver. So he said he saw Vivi at the mansion in the big parties, and she was always sought after. Guys would just chase her, like, you know, tell her she's so beautiful. And, you know, if they had some kind of status in the film industry, they would tell her, you know, I can get you a part doing this and doing that. I guess she just had that attraction. So Hugh Hefner offered her a spread and offered her to be featured in her own audition. Okay, so she would already been known from her movie stuff. I mean, from her TV stuff. Okay, so she gets moved to the head of the line. You know what I mean? Like, if she's already got a little clout, a little status, she don't have to start from the bottom like the normal just nobody girl would have to do. Just somebody just coming in just solely on their looks. She don't have to go through that whole rigmarole. She can just get her own feature, her own audition, and then that's her starting point. And again, just like I was saying, they're saying that posing in Playboy was still risky. It's like, once you do that, like, I can't remember which episode of from last season, but yeah, once you do that, then it's almost like you used up. Like, once people have seen your ass, your cooch, and your tits, the whole, you know, 5 million in addition has seen that, like nobody's going to be knocking down your door to offer you movie roles and parts. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, okay, well, we've already seen everything and we've seen your television stuff. So, you know, so they're saying it's risky. So it wasn't just me being all judgmental and shit. They're actually saying this, you know. So the question is, does it really help your career or does it hurt it? But at any rate, she took the risk. All these women they show in here are pretty. Every last one of them, right? So, but if I saw her and you told me that she was a Playboy model or I don't know, man, she just looked plain. She's like, again, she's pretty, but she looked like a secretary at a high school or like a counselor at a high school or like a teacher that the guys will have a crush on, something like that. She don't look like star, like stunning the way they describing her. So she was the playmate of the month for September of 1967. And Holly Madison actually has this edition and she's showing it. Okay, so at that time, it wasn't all about the nude pictures. You know, they showed like her centerfold was her nude, but then all the other pictures of her are just like lifestyle pictures. Like her, I don't know, what is she doing? She's like in a park or something, playing with like a, you know, it's just like lifestyle, like JCPenney magazine shots. It's not like a full nude pictures. So, okay, so that's the difference. It wasn't just all about the nudity. The only really nude picture was just a centerfold spread, you know, and they're showing her doing some acting stuff. They're showing her reading lines and they got, of course, all the copy talking about her. So it's really like a promo thing. So it was way different then than what it is now. And the difference is, okay, yeah, so this is one thing. Hugh Hefner mostly favored blondes, but she had this, you know, she was Italian, so she had this dark kind of dark brown hair, like really dark. And Holly Madison describes her as extra, extra cute. Yeah, that's what she's more cute than. That's a difference between like cute and beautiful and like gorgeous and like stunning, you know, all those different levels. And she falls into the cute category. But the readers absolutely loved her. So she became so popular that they asked her to come back as Playmate of the Year for 1968. So we see her on the cover. And again, man, she's like a MILF. She looks like a MILF. And she's on this cover. It's like a pink background. She's wearing a pink dress and has like this confetti and stuff. Just look it up. Look up Victoria Vetri Playboy cover. And so I guess with every Playmate of the Year, I don't know if I knew about this, but when you make Playmate of the Year, you get a car. And the car is in this color called Playmate Pink. And we see her, Playmate of the Year, September Delight, Angela Dorian reigns as the premier gatefold girl of the past 12 months. And I'm trying to figure out what this car is. I can't tell what this car is. Is it a Nova? It's a swoop back. I can't tell what this car is. It's an AMX. What the hell is an AMX? Okay. Oh, it's an AMC AMX. So I guess it was the rival of a Corvette. And it's categorized as a family hauler. Anyway, that's what she got for Playmate of the Year. So everything is going good for her, man. Like she came in the door and became Playmate of the Month, Playmate of the Year. She got all her acting roles. So everything should be set for her now, right? Hollywood should be calling, getting these movie roles. So it did work out for her. After she became Playmate of the Year, she started getting bigger roles. Roman Polanski was making Rosemary's Baby. She got a part in Rosemary's Baby. She was the friend of Mia Farrow. Now, I've seen Rosemary's Baby, but that was ages ago. Now I've seen different versions of it. Yeah, so she was Mia Farrow's friend, and they meet in the laundry room in Rosemary Baby. She had on like that. It seemed like they tried to make it look older and more and less. Well, I guess they couldn't have an outshining Mia Farrow. It definitely seemed like that's what the gig was, to be like the, you know, the less stunning friend of Mia Farrow. So after Rosemary's Baby came out, she reverted to Victoria Vetri. So I can't even remember which one is her real name. Because Victoria Vetri sound more Hollywood than Angela Dorian. Like Vivi, really? Vivi would have been, that's a Hollywood name. We always think our names are shit. Like everybody loves my name, but I'm always like, I mean, like everywhere I go, people talk about, like, I've never heard the name before. And I'm like, yeah, because it's, I don't know. But anyway, so she went back to Victoria Vetri. I guess I didn't realize Roman Polanski directed Rosemary's Baby. And so she got more publicity from that. 1968 was a big year for her, and she's on the rise. So at the time, Polanski was living with Sharon Tate. And we see Roman Polanski sitting next to Sharon Tate. And
this is the very beautiful Sharon Tate. I'm sure you've seen in films. And Roman Polanski, best known for his original film, Knife in the Water. She wrote and directed, and he's also responsible for Rosemary's Baby.
Sharon was on set every day because she wanted to be there. Sharon Tate was a beautiful girl. She was a model. She was the epitome of the 60s, doe eyes, beautiful face, just a stunning girl.
Now, when you talk about beautiful, when you talk about stunning, that's Sharon Tate. You know, in all these episodes, the way they describe when these girls walk into, when these Playboy bunnies or these playmates, when they walk into these parties, the way they describe them, you know, a lot of times I'm looking at them like, really? They just look like everybody else. But if they said that about Sharon Tate, I would be like, oh, well, yeah, okay, that's obvious. So that's how she became, I guess, familiar or friendly with Sharon Tate, is because she did the movie Rosemary's Baby, and Sharon Tate was on the set every day. So she was born in Texas. Vivi was born in Texas. She was an Army brat. Okay, so she must have moved to California because they started off describing her as a California girl. But she was a military brat born in Texas. Hold on, who are we talking about? Are we talking about Sharon Tate? Or are we talking about... Okay, so how do we move... So we move to talking about Sharon Tate now. Okay, so... Yeah, because the pictures they're showing are of Sharon Tate. Okay, so Sharon Tate was born in Texas, and she was a military brat, and her mother and father were both in the Army. Her dad was a colonel. So when she was 16, they moved to Italy, and she was in Verona, and they shot a lot of films in Rome, in Verona. And so she would go to watch, I guess at the time, you could go in on the set and watch films be made. So she would go and watch them make the movie. And she met Jack Palance. And Jack Palance was making this film. And he noticed Sharon Tate. He told her, you should probably get into acting because she was so pretty. And so they moved back to the U.S. And she went to Hollywood and said she wanted to get an agent. And she got an agent. And then, that's how she got started in Hollywood. So I didn't realize Sharon Tate was in Playboy. But yeah, I guess Victoria Vetri and Sharon Tate were both in Playboy, and they became close friends, and they bonded over the fact that they were both stunningly beautiful women. That's weird. So they were both just like talking about, oh, I'm beautiful. Oh, I'm beautiful. You're beautiful. Oh yes, you are beautiful too, but I'm beautiful. The way Holly Madison said that they bonded over the fact that they're both beautiful. That's weird. That's a weird take. So they both were using Playboy as a stepping stone in their career. So in Sharon Tate's Playboy pictorial, they got her with red hair. Okay, so they doing a horror theme with hers. They got like Dracula in the background. They got Sharon Tate. She has this red wig on, and she's like, it's almost like this horror, almost like a horror marquee like poster for a movie. And Roman Polanski was the photographer for her pictorial. Okay, so they had just shot a movie called The Fearless Vampire Killer. So this was all themed based on that. Her Playboy pictorial was themed because of the movie she had just shot. So Sharon Tate and Polanski gets married at the London Playboy Club. And hold on, I thought, didn't Polanski, did he have to flee the country because he was messing with young girls or some shit like that? This must have been after this Sharon Tate deal. So they get married at the London Playboy Club, and she got pregnant. Now we're in August 1969. Sharon Tate is pregnant. She, and you guys probably know this story. They're having this party, right? She got a few friends over to her party. Vivi was there, and Vivi was at their home a lot. So at this gathering, there's a knock at the door from a stranger.
He had long, straggly hair, a long beard. You know, in some regards, he looked a little bit disheveled. He seemed a little bit scary. And it was Victoria who said something to the effect of, "This guy is creeping me out." As it would turn out, the man at the door was none other than Charles Manson.
Okay, so now we meet Sarah Levine. She's the host of Not Another True Crime Podcast. And she's, you know, just giving a background on Charles Manson. Man, you know what? If you don't know who the fuck Charles Manson is, I don't know what to tell you. Just go Google it. But that's what she's doing. She's just giving a breakdown on Charles Manson. And we see some pictures of his family, the Charles Manson family, and that whole stuff, you know. So it's pretty much a cult. They were living out on this ranch called Spawn Ranch. And, you know, he just pretty much was a cult leader of these low-life nobodies who, you know, probably used whatever excuse to do the foul shit they were doing. Parents got divorced or whatever. But it's all these hippie-ass followers of Charles Manson. So when Vivi said, this guy is creeping me out, or this guy's a creep, he overheard her. And then this reenactment, you know, he's standing at the door. He never crosses the threshold. Sharon Tate is just kind of like talking to him at the door. They don't say, nobody knows what they're talking about. But for some reason, Vivi looks up and said, this guy is creeping me out. And he looks over like he heard her. And then Sharon Tate closed the door, and Manson is like looking through the window, and then he walks off. But he's like looking like, bitch, I'm going to get you. That's the look he's given. And he walks off. All right. So August 8th, 1969, 1 week later. So again, Sharon Tate, she has guests at her house. She's entertaining again, just like the previous week. And Vivi was invited, but this time Vivi wasn't there. And she decided not to go because she got sick. So she didn't go. And so we see this figure walking up to the house with a knife in his hand. So the Manson family arrived to the house. And we see one with a rope. We see a few with knives and shit. And they park at the bottom of the hill and walk up the driveway. So they cut the phone lines. And another podcast that we're hearing from, her name is Megan Sachs. And she's the host of Women in Crime podcast. And so they cut the line so these people can't make any calls to the cops or whatever, because now they have no phone line. So Manson tells them to go in his house, kill everybody that's in there. That's what he tells his family to do, to go in his house and kill everybody there. And we see crime scene photos of this, just blood and gore and shit all over the, just everywhere, man. And we see them taking out bodies, and all these first responders, these cops, they all have the faces of mortification. So they strung up, I didn't know this, so they strung up Sharon Tate by her legs and hands, and they slashed her to death and killed her baby. So everybody who was in the house, it was Sharon Tate, her good friend, Jay Sebring, Abigail Folger, Roman Polanski's childhood friend, Wojtek Frykowski, all killed, all murdered by the Manson family. So 2 days later, Lino LaBianca and his wife, Rosemary, they were also brutally killed by members of the Manson family. So they were just on a fucking killing spree. So 7 people total dead, and they have no suspect. Because the worst kind of crime and the scariest crime are when it's just random, when just random strangers just murder. Because it's hard to tie it back to somebody. You know what I mean? Like, so when Victoria found out about these murders, she was, of course, horrified. She was supposed to be at this party, at this get-together, and she realized that, you know, she could have been one of the victims. So this had everybody in Hollywood freaked out. Everybody started getting alarm systems, guard dogs. They started, you know how like you hear those stories and people say, oh, that stuff never happens here. You know, they probably left their doors unlocked and shit like that, but not anymore. Those times ended. Now they are securing their houses and like realizing, well, if the shit can happen here in Hollywood, it can happen anywhere. So now we at November 6, 1969, 5 months later. So they got warrants and they got 3 suspects, and they narrowed it down to people from this cult, this ranch, this Spawn movie ranch. So the way they got caught is members of this Manson family, they were stealing cars. And so they raided this Spawn ranch, and they got Charles Manson, Tex Watson, Linda Kasabian, Patricia Krenwinkel, and Susan Atkins. They were all arrested in this raid related to auto theft. And while in prison, Susan Atkins started confessing to a few people in jail that she committed the murders and how they committed the murders. So she started running her mouth, and good she did, because these fucking cops probably would have never tied it back to them. So she started talking, and they linked 11 murders to Tate Cooks. And this murder, this mess and shit, really ended an era of like this just free love, hippy trippy shit. And it sort of ended that innocence, especially in these, you know, this high society. It sort of ended it, and not no longer are hippies looked at as like, oh man, they're just tree huggers, they're just hippies, man. You know, now they're looked at as a threat. And so all that innocent hippy dippy shit is out the window now. Everybody started buying guns. You know, they started protecting themselves. And Vivi started reflecting back to those words she uttered, saying, this guy was creeping me out. And she was concerned that the reason her friends were murdered was because of that. She was thinking that they came back to exact revenge because she called a creepy fuck creepy. Have you ever seen a picture of Manson that wasn't creepy, where he didn't look like some homeless ass creep? He was creepy. And so that hurt his feelings. And he came back and I never knew that part of the story. I never knew why he did it. I never knew why that Manson family committed those murders. I just thought they were just crazy. I mean, well, they are fucking, it's obvious that they're psychos, but I didn't know it was tied to just some words. So she thought that the people who murdered her friends were out to get her. So now she's in this constant state of paranoia and fear, thinking at any moment, they're going to come after her. So soon after those murders, Roman Polanski gave her a gun so she could protect herself. We see like a reenactment of her just sitting in his chair holding his gun. I thought like, I mean, wouldn't like, she's in Hollywood and stuff like that. Wouldn't she get like a bodyguard or something, right? You think she would get a bodyguard? So she took a break from acting, you know, because she was paranoid. She felt that this Manson family was going to come and get her. She sort of took a break and try to figure things out a little bit. But eventually she did start to go back to acting, but her star was sort of fizzling. But when she started back acting, the roles that she started to get were different than the roles she was getting before she posed in Playboy. You know, she wasn't getting any serious roles. It was pretty much be the sexy chick, you know, be seen, not heard type roles. And we see this intro of this movie when dinosaurs ruled the earth. And she was being cast as pretty much the sex symbol. Well, she posed in Playboy. It's hard to go from Playboy to serious roles, just like I was saying. So we see her starring in this When Dinosaurs Ruled the Earth. She's a cave woman with like, so is this, she was a blonde woman of this blonde tribe who was dominated by these dark haired people. And she was supposed to be sacrificed. So she's just running around, titties just bouncing, and she got on like this cave woman bikini. This could be called When Schlongs Ruled the Earth. This could be like a bad porn movie. And we hear Holly Madison reiterating the fact that when you pose for Playboy, don't expect anything other than just being seen as that naked girl. So whatever roles you get, whatever happens after that, you're just that naked girl. And not everybody's going to take you seriously. So she became frustrated by that. And we see her butt naked in this movie. So we see her being fandangled by the dark haired, I guess, tribe leader. And she had lead roles in two B movies. Invasion of the B Girls. Well, literally a B movie. Invasion of the B Girls. B spelled B-E-E. Girls. And so this movie was about these women who were basically bees and they have sex with men and kill them. Jesus Christ. And this other movie is called Group Marriage, starring Victoria Vetri and Amy Eccles. And this movie was just a sex romp. It was about open marriages. And she did a couple of TV spots in 1975. She stopped acting altogether and just kind of faded away. So 1984, Los Angeles, California. Now, at this point, she's kind of retired, but she gets a big opportunity and it's with Playboy. So 1984, Victoria was invited to participate in a special edition called Playmates Forever Part 2. Like this compilation of all the top playmates. So Playboy came knocking at the door, said, hey, we got this old broad playmate compendium. We want you to be a part of it. And she agrees. And now she goes and pulls these old titties in this 1984 Playboy Playmate Hall of Fame type deal. And she actually looks prettier now. This is my opinion. I think she looks prettier now than she did then. She absolutely looked like what you can say stunning now and less cute. She looks, maybe she got that, that's that experience showing. So after that, she was named one of the top 100 centerfolds of all time. And we see this cover, Centerfolds of the Century. So it pretty much validated her. Like, yeah, you know, she had the goods, you know, and she probably could have just, you know, if it wasn't for that Sharon Tate murder and the Manson family shit, it just loomed over her. She actually had like PTSD from it. It like haunted her for the rest of her life. She couldn't get past it. So after Playmates Forever, her career dropped off again. She went into obscurity and sort of just vanished. So she ended up taking a job waitressing at this cafe. So this guy named Bruce Rathgeb, he met Victoria when they were working together in this LA restaurant. That's where their friendship started at. So Bruce was a chef and part-time musician. And I guess, you know, they fell in love pretty quick and they end up getting married within a couple of years of dating. And we see footage from their wedding. So this was in 1987. They got married at Bruce's dad's home in La Jolla, California. So how old would she be now? She looks older than what I imagine she would be. So anyway, we see them cutting the cake and doing all this shit. They're smiling. They're happy. You know, they look real happy. And even still, you know, she found love, got married. Even still, she still couldn't let go of what happened all those years ago to her friends. She couldn't move beyond it. All right. So now we're back at the beginning of this episode, October 16th, 2010. You remember those gunshots, 911 call, cops get there, body, chaos, like a scuffle happened inside the apartment, victim down. So the paramedics are there, they're providing life-saving treatment on this person, but law enforcement is trying to figure out what the hell is going on. They're trying to gather evidence, trying to gather information. They're canvassing the apartment building, trying to talk to the neighbors to see if they can figure out what happened. None of the neighbors saw what happened. They just heard it. You know, they just heard the gunshots and stuff, heard the signs of struggle, heard a lot of movement, a lot of loud noises, and then loud pops. So nobody saw anything. Everybody just heard. Okay, so one neighbor finally came out and he see Bruce Rathgeb lying on the floor with a gunshot wound to his chest. And the way he's laying, so if you can imagine, you know, the apartment building, and it's like the upper apartment building, and Bruce is laying with his back against like the what would you call it, like the wall, the balcony wall of the upper stairs, or you know what is it, what the fuck is it called, like the partition to keep people from falling off the damn upper hallway. And he's facing the door, the apartment door, so he's sitting up with his back braced against the wall and sitting in a pool of blood, of his own blood. He's still alive at this point. The paramedic take him to Cedar Sinai in LA. At this point, he's still alive. Cops makes entrance into the apartment. They see signs of struggle, see shit thrown everywhere, the torn up magazines. And lo and behold, standing right there in the apartment is 66. Okay, so she's 66 years old at this point. 66-year-old Vivi.
The detectives are focused on getting good, solid information from the witnesses. Victoria was able to provide a statement. What did you hear? What did you see?
Victoria gives a statement about what happened. That a drug dealer by the name of Lee had shot Mr. Rathgeb because Mr. Rathgeb had owed the drug dealer money.
Wait a minute. So this turned into a meth deal gone wrong? Oh, damn, man. That's like the bottom of the barrel. A meth deal? So she's, okay. So she married a meth head is what we're hearing. She married a meth head. All right. So the police, you know, they go and they examine the area where they found Bruce on the ground, and they find a little baggie of drugs, and they think it's meth. And also right next to that, they find a 38 caliber shell casing. So Victoria said that Bruce was headed to get money out of her account to pay this guy back. And then, so they're in like the hallway, the upper hallway, and he goes out, you know, Bruce is like walking. Then this dude comes up behind him and shoots him, according to what Victoria is saying and according to this reenactment. That's how they portray it. He leaves out of the apartment, walking down the hallway, but then someone comes up behind him. He turns around and he gets plugged in the chest. So Bruce is still at the hospital, intubated on a ventilator, but he's still alive, but he's unconscious. But he's in such a bad state that the cops are already treating this shit like a homicide. They don't think he's going to make it. They're already treating this like a homicide. So Vivi gives the cops the address of the drug dealer, and they take off immediately to go question this dude and to go see what's up. They get to his house, they start knocking on the door, and they start talking to him. He cooperated. He went to the station to provide a statement. He said, yeah, I know Bruce, but he provided an alibi with witnesses as to where he was. He was like, I know him, but I don't have shit to do with shooting him. They verified his alibi. They verified it was solid, and they release him. They clear him and let him go. So now Vivi is fucking lying. she gave him this lead, and this lead turned out to be false. So they go back to Vivi's house, and they bring her down to the station. She's in the holding tank, and then she started to give them another story.
She's telling them about her life with Bruce.
They'd been married over 20 years. She had a history in the entertainment world, that she was a former Playboy model and a former TV star, and that he was a musician. But they had on and off again struggles with addiction and money issues.
Victoria carried with her a tremendous fear of Manson. She was debilitated in many ways. She tells detectives that they had a very good relationship, a strong relationship, until around the year 2000. And that's when drug use began to interfere with their dynamic and their relationship.
This was a former Hollywood superstar, but at this time in their lives, they were just another couple struggling with substance abuse issues.
Essentially, what Victoria has to say is that she's broke.
And so, being that she was broke, she's on drugs, she don't have any money, she ends up selling her AMX, her AMC AMX, and for money, for drugs, and to live on. And the only income they have, really, is Social Security. Her marriage is breaking down. She's at a wit's end. She's on the last straw. And we hear Holly Madison saying, so many playmates or former playmates die from drug overdoses and suicide. Well, I imagine it's because when you are treated like royalty for such a short and fleeting period of time, and you don't have any other skills or assets or anything to fall back on, then you're just going to spiral. And I imagine that would be in anything that happens like that, where something just comes with little to no work, really, traditional work. And then it's gone. It's taken away from you, or you lose it. It's like you're trying to fill that hole with some of the same shit that you were doing when you had the lifestyle that supported that, and now you don't. Hey, but Holly Madison did all right. So, and we hear Tannenbaum saying that if you look into playmates and bunnies, the casualty rate for mental health and drug addiction and alcoholism is one of the highest of any job in the world. That's what Stella Tannenbaum is saying. Holy shit. And that's what happened to Victoria. So she's telling the cops that the reason they are broke is because of Bruce. And evidently, they broke up. Bruce left the house, but he came back to sort of reconcile. But things didn't go as he planned. There was no reconciliation. They had a couple of drinks. But after a couple of drinks, shit starts to go bad real fast. And that's when Bruce started to like tear up her shit. He started to tear. That's why the magazines were torn up. The ones with her playmate covers. He started to hit her. He started to beat her. And, according to her, this is what she's saying. They started to fight over money. So Bruce left. He started to leave. And she follows behind him, like she said the drug dealer did. But instead, it's her who followed behind him. He turns around. And she plugs his ass in the chest. I want to know if it's the gun that Roman Polanski gave her. So the news come out, former playmate shot her husband. So she admitted to doing it. So now the cops need to find this gun. They asked her, where's the gun? And she said the gun is in an apartment in a box. They received her consent to go back into the apartment to recover that gun. It was a Walther PPK 380 auto pistol. And exactly. This is the gun that Roman Polanski gave her in 1969. So she held on to this gun all this time, waiting for the Manson family to come after her. But yet she ends up shooting her husband with it. And some of the neighbors actually report that after they heard the shots and shit, they heard her say to Bruce, "No more Charlie, no more Charlie." And it appears that she could have been confusing, well, especially if she was drunk and high, she could have been confusing Bruce with Charles Manson. So now that she's confessed, they throw her in the slammer. And now we got to figure out, did Bruce live or not? So the detective go back to the hospital and try to follow up and interview Bruce. Okay, so Bruce lives 3 inches away from the center of his chest. And so they ask him about his relationship with Victoria. According to Bruce, he felt that Victoria was experiencing mental health issues and that she had always been paranoid of him cheating on her. She was always accusing him of stuff. And he said he was always loyal. But, you know, when he came to try to reconcile, just like she said, they ended up arguing and he tried to leave and she didn't want him to leave. She just kept telling him to stop. He turns around and look at her. And at this point, he was Charles Manson to her. And, you know, unfortunately, he got plugged for it, for her mental issues and coming over there, probably provoking her. So we see this headline that says, "Prosecutors charged 1968 Playboy playmate with attempted murder." And she was facing up to 25 years in prison for attempted murder. But in the end, she pleads guilty to attempted voluntary manslaughter and she gets 9 years instead of the 25. So she pled out, got 9 years. Wow. So because Bruce did say she had mental issues going on, the court considered that. So that's why she got a lighter sentence compared to what she could have gotten. And we see pictures of her. Wow, man. Yeah. So she's 66, but she looks 86, man. God damn, man. Time in life is the great equalizer, man. So, I mean, you can only ride on looks, man, for so long. You can only ride on looks for so long. Looks and I mean, stay healthy, stay in shape and do all that shit, man. But you just got to know you only prolonging it. And when your life is just built on it, like I've been, you know, coming across a lot of these young dudes, these bodybuilders and shit dying from steroids and SARMs and all these other kind of performance enhancing drugs at young ages because of this Instagram, these Instagram models. And like I'm talking dudes too, not just females. When I say Instagram models, I'm talking about these Instagram, they call them Instagram fitness influencers. And these teenagers and stuff, man, these young people taking all these drugs, trying to look like Captain America and like these suit and Thor, you know, because that's like the standard of what a dude is supposed to look like now. And yeah, man, you know, looks, that shit fades away. That shit doesn't last. And, you know, a lot of times we see in these series, these Playboy murder series, is that I think a lot of this tragedy is attributed to these women don't have anything else to fall back on, or they just let this life of looks get carried away. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know, man. You know, I'm talking out my ass. I'm no expert on any of this, but it's just crazy to see these before and after pictures. But you can tell life kicked her in the ass with the whole foot.
Victoria's story is really a crazy Hollywood tale. You start out with a stunning working actress, poses for Playboy, gets chosen Playmate of the Year, becomes best friends with one of the most famous actresses now, who sadly was killed by the Manson family, and then to later have a tragedy happen, you know, between her and her husband.
This case is a tragedy all around. You have someone who was shot, he almost lost his life, but you also have a woman who lived her life
in fear. She lived under the shadow of an event that she simply could not escape. Victoria and Bruce would ultimately divorce while Victoria was still in prison. Victoria was released from prison in 2019 and she moved to Arizona. She wanted to put the whole incident behind her and start a new chapter in her life. Victoria was able to track down the person who purchased that pink car from her.
After everything that happened, Victoria's been given a second chance. Victoria was reunited with her pink Playmate of the Year car and makes appearances at car shows with it.
I'm not a spring chicken. I just had a birthday, and I think I'm in my 70s now, 74.
I think it's nice that Victoria is getting a fresh start in life and making positive changes and enjoying doing the car shows with her Playmate of the Year car.
And that's going to do it for this episode. Please send all your questions and comments and recommendations for a documentary for me to feature on this podcast to docutalkthrough@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.